Yes, in a moment. It's our guest, Linda Moulton Howe, investigative reporter with several major segments. One, of course, will have to do with a crashed 1953 UFO case, an incredible story in Garrison, Utah. And then also, she had a chance to get some very fascinating audio with the former Canadian Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer, who talked about UFOs. All of that in a moment with our guest, Linda Moulton Howe, on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe, an Emmy Award-winning television producer, investigative reporter. She is an author who goes directly to men and women at the forefront of science and environmental challenges and to firsthand eyewitnesses of high strangeness. She's a graduate of Stanford University with a master's degree in communication, and she has devoted her documentary, film, television, radio career to productions concerning science, medicine, and the environment with two incredible stories tonight. Linda Moulton Howe. Hello, Linda. How was your Thanksgiving?
Well, George, it was interesting that it was exactly 1 year ago that I left Philadelphia trying to get away from all the water and the flooding there and moved to beautiful Albuquerque, and then found myself going back almost exactly the same day to have Thanksgiving with some friends and relatives there, and thought, oh no, they're having one of those nor'easters, and gritting my teeth, I'm going to fly back into that weather that I was trying to escape. But something kept all that bad weather away, and it was beautiful. So I had a wonderful Thanksgiving there and back here.
Hey, yeah, the hour before you, Linda, tongue-in-cheek with a company that provides UFO abduction insurance, they pay out a $10 million policy at $1 a year. Now you're a tough, hard-nosed investigative reporter, but even you like a chuckle once in a while, don't
yeah.
you?
Yeah, but it's kind of ironic tonight that that would be the lead hour when what I'd like to share with you and Coast tonight are two really fascinating hours that, to me, combine what we're going to hear from this former Minister of Defense from Canada, combined with a U.S. Air Force pilot retired. It seems to me that every month of every year, we're getting closer to sort of like the scale is getting heavier and heavier on the eyewitness testimony from people who were firsthand in governments and they know what they're talking about.
Maybe one day, Linda, there will be some real UFO abduction insurance.
Well, maybe that's where all this is headed. But, you know, it was 8 years ago, on July 4th, 1997, I was in Roswell, New Mexico, and it was the 50th anniversary of that famous UFO crash that was discovered by the rancher named Mac Brazel near Corona. And as we all know now, almost around the world, U.S. military and intelligence units retrieve wreckage that somebody said it has to be dismissed as a weather balloon. But joining us in that anniversary celebration back in Roswell 8 years ago was an Army man who declared, I mean, it was strongly stated, the crash and crashes were definitely extraterrestrial, and it was not the only one that the United States government had covered up. And that person making those strong words was U.S. Army Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. At that anniversary in Roswell, he released his groundbreaking book, The Day After Roswell. And Colonel Corso wrote astonishing details in that book about U.S. government programs to retrieve extraterrestrial technology from downed craft and to back engineer and patent it inside American corporations. And at my website, www.earthfiles.com, I have a report of this former Minister of Defense, his interview, plus a list by Colonel Corso himself of what he said was ET technology that we were back engineering in the United States, and it included fiber optics and night vision. And he also told me that he had been he had seen with his own eyes highly classified documents dated as early as 1951. That's only 4 years after 47 Roswell, about unusual deaths of animals around the world in which similar patterns of tissue were taken without blood, tracks, or signs of struggle. And the documents identified the mutilators as, quote, extraterrestrial biological entities, unquote, according to Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso. Well, recently, at a September 2005 exopolitics symposium that was organized by Mike Bird in Toronto, one speaker with 50 years of Canadian government service said Colonel Corso was right, that there are extraterrestrial entities and ET advanced technologies. His name is Paul Hellyer, who was Canada's Minister of Defense from 1963 to 1967 when Pierre Trudeau was Prime Minister. Before then, Mr. Hellyer had been an elected member of Parliament and was Associate Minister of Defense. After his MOD work, he was appointed Minister of Transport and Housing from 67 to 69, and he stayed in the Parliament House until 1974. His recent frankness was provoked by contact, he said, with an American Air Force general who said, quote, every word in Colonel Philip J. Corso's book is true and more, unquote. Further, Paul Hellyer thinks that the public has a right to know what governments know. Since senators in the Canadian Parliament are appointed until age 75 and they don't have to worry about re-elections, Mr. Hellyer is urging some of them to organize public Parliament hearings about what he says is a UFO ET presence. And this week I asked Paul Hellyer what the United States Air Force General told him in the past few months that was so convincing. And here is an excerpt from that interview.
Here it is. Very special interview.
There have been visitors from space, and that they were as real as the airplanes flying overhead, and that they were designated by Nathan Twining as enemy aliens, and that the United States appeared to be following a military course, which would put them in a position to be able to shoot down some of these vehicles. And knowing the military, that causes me some concern, because I don't know whether they're a real threat to the United States and the world or whether they aren't. And I think we should find out more about it and know more about it so that the public is in on the debate and not just leave it to the generals and the top civil servants who think they own all this information.
And the U.S. Air Force general retired did comment to you about Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso's book, The Day After Roswell.
Yes, indeed. Well, he said that it was all true. And he said every word of it is true and more. And he did elaborate a little bit in that he said that there had been face-to-face discussions
between
the alien visitors and members of the United States government or armed forces or both.
And did he explain if our government still felt that these were enemy aliens, as Nathan Twining had assigned that phrase to them in the 1947 time period?
No, and I think he, if anything, he gave me the impression that maybe they weren't that concerned, but I don't know, you know, I want to be careful with that one, because, but he didn't seem to be as concerned about the potential consequences of some accidental or deliberate destruction of the space vehicles as I did.
And if he was not concerned when you talked with him, what, within the last year?
Yes.
Then what is his major concern?
I think he may be writing a book too. And I don't know what his major concern is, but he certainly, I think, feels that, you know, there should be more public disclosure than there has been. That certainly, otherwise he wouldn't have taken the trouble to verify that what Colonel Corso had said was basically correct.
And this is a name of a United States Air Force general that we all would know if we heard it?
I doubt it, no.
But he held a capacity in which he had firsthand knowledge about extraterrestrial biological entities?
I can't even answer that, but he certainly had no, there was no hesitation in his voice whatsoever. You know, it wasn't a question of, you know, I've heard rumors or something like that. It was just bang, every word is true and more.
And if it's all true, then it means face-to-face encounters with extraterrestrial biological entities, the retrieval of advanced technologies, and efforts to back engineer those technologies in the United States?
Yes, I would say so.
Did the U.S. Air Force retired general that you talked with describe in any form the types of non-humans that the government of the United States is dealing with?
No.
But he talked about more than one type?
Yes.
I mean, they could still consider something to be a threat?
They could, absolutely. And if there's a real threat, I think the people have a right to know about it. That would give some legitimacy to some of the American military plans. After I made the speech recently, I was talking to a woman who said that her son was an airline pilot, and they were shadowed all the way across the country, and every time they came in to contact with another radar, they would ask that they track these vehicles. And then finally, when they got into Toronto and they went into a debriefing room, why, they were just told again, it didn't happen, you didn't see anything.
And the shadowing you're referring to is that the pilots knew that something that they couldn't identify as an airplane was trailing their plane.
Right, exactly, trailing or alongside.
Why do you think, when you were Minister of Defense in 1963 to 67, that you didn't see anything about the UFO phenomenon then?
I don't know. I'm very curious. Actually, you know, I got reports of sightings, but all the reports said beside each sighting was either an explanation or no explanation.
And when you tried to follow up, what happened?
I didn't try to follow up because I was too busy doing other things. It wasn't at the top of my agenda by any means.
And today in 2005, learning what you are learning, how would you translate that lack of information back in the 60s? Was somebody deliberately trying to keep the Minister of Defense in Canada out of the extraterrestrial UFO loop?
I don't think so, but you never know, because often they call the permanent government doesn't like to share information with politicians.
In other words, those that are not elected and have access to highly classified information consider the elected to be transitory and not having a need to know?
Absolutely.
Well, that's my understanding in the United States as we speak in 2005.
Yeah. Is it true that Jimmy Carter tried to find out something and was told that he wasn't cleared for it?
That's my understanding. And if this is the case in your government, in our government now, what do you think it is going to take to change this policy of denial in the interests of national security?
Well, it's going to take a high public awareness that really demands, to know the facts.
But it's catch-22. How do we get to high awareness when the governments have drawn these solid block walls against the public and the media knowing facts?
Well, that's the reason for the hearing, in the hope that there will be another hearing, more important one, south of the border, where there are more witnesses that can come forward and where hopefully the mainline press would find it impossible to deny the importance of it.
And the importance of this is understanding the cover-up, George. And in just a few sentences in The Day After Roswell, Lieutenant Colonel Philip J. Corso said, quote, "As the military tried to figure out what it was that had crashed, where it had come from, and what its inhabitants' intentions were, a covert group was assembled under the leadership of the Director of Intelligence, Admiral Roscoe Hillenketter, who was the first director of the CIA, to investigate the nature of the flying disks and collect all information about encounters with these phenomena, while at the same time, publicly and officially, discounting the existence of all flying saucers. This operation has been going on in one form or another for more than 50 years amid complete secrecy, unquote.
Linda, nice job on this. First of all, when the Hell Your Story broke last week, I said this could be one of the biggest UFO disclosure stories I've seen in a long time.
Right.
And I do have to tell you, about 6 months ago, you might remember, I was talking about some government officials were working on a plan to go for full disclosure. And after hearing you talking with Hellyer, I am convinced that that is very, very close now. I was called about 3 weeks ago from someone who's working with them, and he merely said, George, we're just finalizing some things that we're working on, but it's going to be very soon. When that happens, rest assured, I'm bringing you in on it with me, because it is supposed to be major, and maybe this Paul Hellyer disclosure might be the beginning, might be the step that they were waiting for, and he may very well be aware of them. I have a feeling they're looking for someone to, as we used to say in football, create some daylight for some runners, and he may be the one doing that right now.
And what's interesting to me, as we go into this break, that I'm going to have some comments from a United States Air Force man on this crash burial in Utah. And in all cases, what keeps being raised by everybody is, could one of these intelligences out there still be considered a quote-unquote enemy alien, as General Nathan Twining said in 47? And if so, why? And if there is that point of view, what would there be about 2006 that they've decided that they have to open up no matter what is out there?
What a story. I mean, absolutely stunning. And, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. There's a bigger story here, Linda.
Yo, there's so much more to unfold. And technology, this gigantic issue of what we have that is from off-planet, that has been being developed and put into technology today, is perhaps also a very sensitive button, because if governments and corporations have patented and made money off of a subject that they have said to so many people it doesn't exist, that might be a little embarrassing at some point for governments.
Were you surprised by Hellyer's apparent nonchalant attitude about the UFOs? I mean, I would have been, even considering the position he had as Minister of Defense, I would have been more excitable about this.
Well, he said in another part of our interview, when I asked him about what was happening in 63 to 67 specifically, was he getting reports from the United States? Because that was a huge time in terms of animal mutilations and craft sightings. And he said no, that the reports that came to his desk were exactly as he said. They were generated from inside Canada. But an interesting thing, was back in Corso's book. He said that he and General Trudeau, who were working in the Eisenhower administration, that they contacted this Dr. Wilbert Smith, who was also working in the Department of Transport. This is long before Paul Hellyer. But they were urging the government of Canada to investigate the nature of alien technology. Mm-hmm. There was this Canada-U.S. link. And why was Paul Hellyer kept out of any kind of an intimate loop? That's why I asked him the question, could it have been calculated?
I got to tell you, Linda, your next story may be one of the biggest I've ever heard in a very long time. You are talking about a possible crashed UFO in 1953 in a dry lake bed near Garrison, Utah. This is a major story. If you go to the coasttocoastam.com website, take a look at the picture linked up with lindasearthfiles.com that she has sent us of this triangular-shaped object that truly looks like a very large UFO that was apparently buried. We'll be back with her in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Linda Moulton Howe is going to stick around a little bit next hour as well and take some phone calls from you, because I'm getting fast blasted with all kinds of UFO questions, and she's the one to answer that. So we will keep her around for a bit, and then we'll go into our open lines. And, of course, in a moment, the 1953 UFO crash burial. Very strange story indeed. Also, time to say hello to all of you listening on your favorite radio stations across North America. Hello to you, strong supporters of Coast to Coast AM. Stream Link members, you call themselves the Coast Riders when they are chatting. Special hello there to Sherry from Branson, Missouri. Nighthawkzone.com, 4 months old today. Happy anniversary, all of you. And the original Fantastic Four and Pirates, headed up by old Spike Mike. And then those of you in the National Radio Club, Yahoo chat rooms and various chat rooms, Sorcery IRC, hello to all of you as we get ready to roll on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, I'm George Norrie with our special guest tonight, investigative reporter Linda Moulton Howe. Now, Linda, this picture that you sent us that's now on the coasttocoastam.com website via your earthfiles.com website, tell us a little bit about the picture first, if you would, and then we'll go into the story.
Right. It is really important, and it goes back to 1993 when there were some UFO investigators who had talked with a former United States Air Force captain who told them that he knew through a friend who worked in the Defense Intelligence Agency that the Dress Lake Bed, this lake bed is near a facility that is a desert research place, and they call it Dress, that there had been a very large, what he said was, UFO from outer space vehicle that had crashed in that lake bed in the year 1953, and it was too big and had to be buried. And when these investigators, on the basis of that conversation, went on their own to this, what looks always like an abandoned facility, you would never believe that it was actually operational. That's why a lot of people think it's like an intelligence safe house hiding in plain sight.
Yep.
They, let's put it this way. They went down a coal chute, and they got into a basement, and there they found 24 large, high-altitude aerial photographs. And at my website, earthfiles.com, in this four-part series that I'm doing on this Dress, we'll call it the Dress Lake Bed crash burial, I have several photographs that show from the original, 1953, has the date, June 11th, 1953, when all of these large photographs were taken, one of which is at Earth Files, and some others, and I come up into the modern day at the end of the 90s, and I also show a USGS Terra Server image from a satellite, and that triangular feature is as prominent today as it was in those June 11th, 1953 photos, and part of the story is that investigators went to a geologist with those aerial photographs and said, what could make this? And the geologist did some work out there at the site and said, this is not nature, this is not runoff, this is something that was constructed, meaning there had to be construction. And this triangle in that photograph, as I point out at Earth Files, is huge. It's 4,400 feet on the long sides and 2,700 feet on the shorter side.
Oh,
right.
And how high is it?
Well, I have a photograph trying to give scale. I'm down in what is essentially the top of the triangle. And when you're in there, you think that you're on total flat land. This was one of the strangest things. I was there in July, and I tried to find the edges. I had looked at all these aerial photographs, and I wanted to find the edges. And the funny thing about it is, not just my experience, but other investigators, you cannot get a sense of that triangular edge when you're actually on the lake bed.
And you say it's triangular. John Lear says that it's more like a flattened egg, almost oval, very close. You're both probably pretty accurate there.
Well,
it doesn't look, it's got some dimension to it.
Saw my presentation on this for the first time just about 2 or 3 weeks ago in Vegas, and He and Ron Blackburn had been doing their own independent investigation, and I think what he meant was they and I and others have done some remote viewing that I'm going to talk about in a few minutes.
Okay.
And they're talking about the center of the triangle where they think this thing came down and was buried. The triangle itself is a huge mammoth triangle, not to be confused. The triangular construction, I believe, relates to a military project with bulldozers. The object would be in the middle of that triangle if you look at earthfiles.com and those photos.
That explains it then.
And when you go into this four-part report, the fourth one is with remote viewing by the talented Joe McMonagle. And he did fascinating drawings. And you see what he saw as a remote viewer coming down. And to give some history to this, let's go back 52 years ago on May 20th of 1953. That is a date that has come up through the UFO investigation world as something supposedly crashing near Kingman, Arizona. Now, what no one has talked about is the fact that 3 weeks later, on this date of June 11th, 1953, if you draw a straight line on a map, you can go right straight north 200 miles from Kingman to this dry lake bed east of the Fish Lake National Forest. And we know that we've got these photographs, at least two dozen, with dates on them of June 11th, 1953, of this huge, huge triangular feature. And, George, they did a grid pattern. The photographs are overlapping grids. Somebody was focused on that triangle for unknown reasons.
Hmm.
And it's only 3 miles away. That is what is called the Desert Research Experimental Station, that some people call DRESS because it's the acronym. Well, it's interesting that that was built in 1933, a CCC project, and it's was designed to try to deal with how do you, when there's drought and dryness, what do? How do you make plants? How do you help ranchers during a drought time? What can you do to help with drought? That's how this DRES facility came about. But over the years, and I'm going to go right to something that one of the investigators told me on 9/11, that very day, at the night. It was a total fluke. They just happened to have made an investigation trip out, and they said that the DRESS facility that is supposed to be managing desert plants was lighted up on the night of September 11th, 2001, and stayed lighted for a week.
Weird.
Okay. Now, the location of this triangle is also 175 miles south of that highly classified Dugway Proving Grounds. We don't know if there's a connection at all.
Right, okay.
But this United States Air Force pilot says that he has firsthand knowledge that a large aerial vehicle, this is a quote, not from this world, unquote, impacted in 1953 where the triangle feature was dug to bury the craft and perhaps to provide, this is interesting, to provide a permanent marker in the lake bed for some kind of targeting, perhaps by the non-humans, but the exact purpose of that huge triangle is still unknown. And two Californians that I know, Lester Velez and Steve Jones, they became convinced by both of the retired U.S. Air Force men, the captain and this pilot. Both of the men said a large UFO had crashed, it was too big to transport, it had been buried, and recently I was able to talk with the pilot who requests anonymity, and here is an excerpt from that interview.
Okay, I can't wait for this one. Here we go.
What I understand from Steve Jones is that you were on a recovery team?
Well, in the Air Force, which I'm not going to talk about, with all kinds of things. I can't talk about it. They will shoot me.
Were those things related to the extraterrestrial biological entity phenomenon?
You're making it hard. I can't talk about that stuff. They weren't from this world, let's put it that way.
Okay. And what is your personal firsthand knowledge about the dry lake bed triangle that is in the high altitude photographs dated June 11th, 1953?
Well, that's a crash that happened back in late 52 or 53. I don't remember exact date now, but it crashed there, not in Kingman, and they buried it there.
And do you know for a fact that some sort of extraterrestrial vehicle was buried inside of that area that is the triangular pattern near the dress facility?
Well, the ship was 150 feet in diameter. It was an oblong ship. It was about 3 stories high. Now, you can't pack that up on a car and drive it off. You can't helicopter it out. And the metal, you can't cut it up. So they got to put it somewhere.
And what is the source of your information? Can you?
That ought to tell you.
And what did our government do?
Start digging a big hole.
How did they do that?
With a lot of army guys and shovels. I mean, they dug for days and days and days and days. It's pretty sandy out there, so it's pretty easy. Bulldozers and whatnot.
But burying something that's 3 stories high, that's at least 30 feet high, by 50 feet in diameter, that's pretty big.
Well, half of it was already buried when I finally settled down, so I had to dig the other half out.
It's still buried in October of 2005, as far as you know?
As far as I know, yeah. I haven't been there in probably a good 10 years or so, and it was there when I was there last, so.
And is the dress facility a hiding in plain sight intelligence operation in which there are underground facilities to access the buried craft?
Well, it used to be. It's not active anymore, but there used to be some underground walkway to the site and into the ship.
And you know that firsthand?
And I walked in the ship myself.
And do you know which type of entity it's linked with?
The Zeta Reticulan.
The gray-skinned ones with the vertical pupiled reptilian eyes?
The small gray, yeah, I guess that's what you call them, yeah. They're not really reptilian eyes, but okay.
Well,
they're brown, black eyes, but...
Do you have any understanding why the 1953 aerial that was taken on June 11th shows a large triangular unnatural pattern? Why a triangle?
Who knows? That those people did all kinds of weird things.
In other words, that the digging and the burying leaving that triangular pattern may have been for some reason.
There's probably some aerial reason for the other ships to come in and land. Most likely, you might guess.
Now, George, that is probably one of the more powerful statements that I've heard from somebody saying that they had firsthand even going in something that was underground that was supposed to be, quote-unquote, not from this world.
This guy's dead serious, Linda. He sounds like he means exactly what he's saying.
Yeah, exactly. And I talked about all this with MJ-12 researcher Ryan Wood, and Ryan has worked a lot on cases with Joe McMonagle of the Intuitive Intelligence Applications in Virginia.
Right.
He's maybe one of the most talented remote viewers around, and I prepared a sealed envelope that had only a Xerox of one of the June 11th, 1953 aerial photographs in that envelope. It had the latitude, longitude on the back of the photograph. I taped the envelope. I did vertical lines along the glued and the taping. So if anything were torn open at all, I mean in the slightest, those vertical lines would be broken. And I got the envelope back after the remote viewing was done completely and totally as I had sent it. And the first reviewing sketch was done on October 13th, and it sort of stunned me. It's in one of my reports at Earth Files, and the first thing that he got, he drew a triangle. He indicated the pattern in the desert location. He had the directions right. He had the point headed exactly the way it is, everything. And with his sketch, he had those lists of first impressions that people get.
Yeah.
Low mountains on the horizon, desert floor, feeling like I'm in the desert southwest. Ground pattern, possibly medium to large, well-defined but slightly worn. Triangular in shape, even-sided on two edges, slightly smaller or shorter on the third edge. Pattern is a ground indentation, downward sloping from indentation at edges. And here is something strange he got wrong, but I'm going to talk about the implications. He said the size is approximately 60 meters or feet on a side. Well, we know from the geology survey that it's 4,400 feet long. And I've talked about this with Ryan. Is it possible that in the remote viewing, that Joe McMonagle was picking up a previous crash in the lake bed of a smaller object that might have happened in the 1940s, because there's a lot more to this remote viewing. And I know we're coming up to the break. I'll just give you a few highlights, and maybe we can talk a little bit more about this after the break and
sure.
before calls.
Sure.
This is what he went beyond the sketch. The indentation was created by two large machines which cut approximately 1.5 feet of topsoil from the surface, removing it. And we know we've heard about that in other UFO crash retrieval cases. Soil was removed to clean up what appears to be some kind of an impact site or what might be a vehicle crash site. Remember, he doesn't know anything we're talking about. He's just doing remote viewing on a closed envelope. Removal of toxic waste or material possibly being carried by a vehicle that impacted in the center of the area of the triangle pattern. There was more soil removed from the center than the edges. That's very consistent with what the Air Force men said. Original vehicle probably impacted at an angle. All traces of impacting vehicle were removed. Date of impact was approximately 1938 to 40. That is an entire decade and a couple of years
before
1953.
The other one. How many are there? Yeah, absolutely.
So this is a very interesting question. He's got so much right. Why would the size and the date? Is it possible that two things happened out there? And we can talk about this after the break, because I interview people who live out in that Garrison Baker area. And I'm telling you, George, they have seen some weird things back
that
in the 50s.
That is true. And quick question, why hasn't anybody really attempted to excavate out there?
Well, it's federal property.
So what's on top of it?
It's a lake bed.
But there's no lake bed. No building, there's nothing up there, no other structures on top of that?
Nothing. The lake bed is a dry lake bed, and you can see the cracked white soil in the photographs that I've got at Earth Files.
Well, we got to get some kind of airborne radar or something to penetrate and take a look at that.
Exactly.
It's got to be done. Got to be done. Okay, Linda, stay with us. We'll continue talking with you about this incredible story. And then we'll also open up the phone lines. And I tell you what, I do want to go into open lines later tonight, but at least next hour, you keep calling, we'll keep talking with Linda Moulton Howe on some incredible stories here. Absolutely stunning. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.